Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
It was a criminal think tank.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sataro. This is episode 162, a talk with David Chino Villarente. Villarente is an artist and author who has been an integral part of graffiti culture since the 1980s. He is a well-regarded artist whose tags and pieces have ended up on television and in magazines. He was also the editor of the influential Graphflix column at The Source, which was one of the key ways for people around the world to keep up to date on what was new in the world of street art. Villarente has written several books about graffiti, including the three-volume Peace Book series with our episode 124 guest, Sasha Jenkins. You can't talk about graffiti without seeing it, of course, so we've created an image gallery to go along with this episode, and it's linked in the show notes for this episode at thecyphershow.com. Every time you hear this sound, you'll find an associated image in the gallery. We talked to Villarente at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another great graffiti artist, Blake Keo Letham, who joined his high school classmate MC Search on episode 55. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For July, we've got the Bomb Squad's Keith Shockley telling us what he taught Puffy about remixes and talking about the beat Lenny Kravitz stole from him. Anyone who signs up by Friday, July 15th at noon Eastern will get access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's Kojak's favorite graph writer, David Chino Villarente.
So, you know, one of the things that you're always asked about all the time is Banksy. What do you think of Banksy? Is he a graffiti artist? But when I was doing research about you, I found out you actually had a much more amusing Banksy story about when you went to London before anyone knew who he was and ran into his art.
We were in London. I was there for a trip. I was speaking at, I think, an event at the Rex Hotel back in the late 90s. And everywhere I went, I saw these signs that said, designated legal graffiti area by Her Majesty. And it had a very official royal looking crest. And there were signatures all over these walls. And I started bringing a can of paint out with me. And I started writing on the walls. And I mean, it's broad daylight. I'm a block and a half from Buckingham Palace and near the Marble Arch and, you know, very busy streets. And I'm contributing signatures. I'm going a little larger than most of the people that wrote on the wall. And I'm contributing signatures wherever I see this. And then I'm with a bunch of my friends that are from the UK, graffiti writers. And they're like, she's like, what the fuck are you doing? It's like, it's legal. And they're like, this is a joke. This guy's a street artist. And it was one of the first times I heard the term street artist. And I was impressed. I was fooled. And so I have a very different relationship with his work. And then, you know, flash forward to 2013 when he did his residency here in New York.
In October 2013, Banksy held a residency in New York called Better Out Than In. Each day of the month, a new piece appeared somewhere throughout the city.
I mean, I probably had a sizable window to become familiar with his work prior to most New Yorkers. So I don't have the same relationship with it. I'm not as disturbed or pissed off. I worked for a spray paint company between 2001 and 2005, Molotow Premium. Most people refer to it as Belton. Our company was located in Lahr, Germany, near the Black Forest. We were the first American to import the brand. And by all accounts, we're the first spray paint company to do all of the national arts and materials trade shows. We ended up in Pearl Paint, Blix, Michaels. So we were the first quote-unquote graffiti product to end up in store shelves, on store shelves in the United States, which is interesting because you can walk into a Utrecht now and a quarter of the store is devoted to graffiti products. So we were doing all the arts and materials trade shows in the early 2000s. But in 2002, we were a part of a big show that Molotow hosted in Hamburg called Urban Discipline. Banksy was one of the artists that was featured in the gallery there as well. It was interesting because we took a bullet train from Cologne to Hamburg. And while we were on the train, they announced that Germany had just made it into the World Cup against Spain. So by the time we got off the train in Hamburg, it was like New Year's or Mardi Gras. I don't know what to compare the energy to, but it had the intensity of maybe the ball dropping at 12 o'clock.
Oh.
And that was the night of the show. So needless to say, the energy in the room was pretty electric. And I have an interesting story. We were I met two girls at a party while I was there. They started showing me around Hamburg post-show. And we were by a pier at night, and they were showing me this pier that was visible from the waterside, from the promenade. And it was painted for the event the year before. And I'm looking at this mural, and I can hear someone come running into the park, and I can hear a ball of the spray can rattling in his plastic bag. And it was Baron André from France. And him and Banksy had just gotten chased, and apparently Banksy did a stencil on the back of the police station, but because no one spoke German, they didn't realize it was the back of a precinct. And they simply opened the gate and pulled him inside. And André took off running. So apparently Banksy was released the next day because so many people were arrested during their celebration of the World Cup that he was simply put in a drunk tank for the evening. So that's the extent of my Banksy stories. And I was good friends with Robo. I was friends with Robo prior to him passing. I've got a crew of guys from the UK that have been down with us since the 80s.
Right.
And Robo has a pretty highly publicized conflict that went on with Banksy for some time.
The feud between Banksy and English underground graffiti artist King Robo dates back, in Robo's telling, to the first meeting between the two in the 90s, which ended with Robo slapping the now famous artist. The two began painting over each other's pieces beginning in 2009, and the feud continued until Robo suffered an unrelated, life-threatening head injury in the spring of 2011. The injury left Robo comatose, and he passed away in 2014. After his passing, Banksy turned one of the locations they feuded in Camden into a tribute to Robo, which you can see in the gallery for this episode.
I don't have the same disappointments, or I'm not angry with him. I find his work amusing. I think it's very witty. It's clever. And I can't say that about all street artists.
Right, right. It's funny that it took till 1999 for you to hear the term street artist, being that like you were in the graffiti culture for so long.
There were a ton of guys that did street art, but we just didn't know what to label it growing up. You know, Renee from Soho would take up these big walls and it would say, "I am the best artist."
Rene Moncada painted his giant murals reading, "I am the best artist," all over Soho from the 70s to the 90s. He claimed that the murals, for which he always got permission, were a thumb in the nose to the art community. The murals would frequently be defaced to say things like, "I am the best fartist," or "I am the best anus."
And he was only on my radar because he would take the wall and he'd typically go over me. And I'd come back and fix it. And he'd come back and go back over me. And I'd come back and fix it. And there was a gentleman that drew ships or boats and empty parking lots. And then the shadow man, Richard Hambleton, was probably quite possibly the first street artist.
Artist Richard Hambleton, a contemporary of Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat, is most famous for his shadow man paintings of the early 1980s. Each painting resembles a life-size silhouetted image of some mysterious person, a splashy shadow figure. These shadow paintings were splashed and brushed with black paint on hundreds of buildings and other structures across New York City. Locations were believed to be calculated for maximum impact upon unsuspecting pedestrians.
Keith Haring, for that matter. But Richard Hambleton was probably one of the first street artists who I really started to pay attention to. And Keith, going back to Keith Haring, that was part of what sparked this slow-burning fire as a child, the curiosity. You know, I would take the subway with my mom as a small child, and we would see these Keith Haring chalk drawings in the empty subway ad spaces.
In the early 1980s, Keith Haring created hundreds of drawings in the New York subway system. They were generally done in chalk on the empty black spaces that would otherwise house advertisements. Haring said of the drawings, "I kept seeing more and more of these black spaces, and I drew on them whenever I saw one. Because they were so fragile, people left them alone and respected them. They didn't rub them out or try to mess them up. I gave them this other power. It was this chalk-white, fragile thing in the middle of all this power and tension and violence that the subway was. People were completely enthralled."
And because they were so prolific, I was under the impression that the city was doing it. And when I asked my mom who was doing that, she said, "Oh, someone's doing that illegally." And I was fascinated with this concept that this man was everywhere I went before I got there.
Right.
And it was a part of the intrigue that really pushed me to start researching and figuring this whole graffiti thing out.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of your mom, one of the funniest things that I managed to scope out about you was, I know your mom had suspicions you were doing graffiti in the you know, early mid 80s, but really had it confirmed for her on television, right?
Oh yeah. So I'm out, and the irony is I'm out painting subway trains, and I come home and my mom just starts clapping her hands. She was like, "Your name was on Kojak tonight." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And there was a made for TV movie, Kojak, The Belarus Files. And apparently this spy is being chased by some assassins, and he makes his way into the subway and from one car to another. And as he's walking through the car, I have some signatures there. And as he goes to exit one car and enter the other, he slowly opens the door and turns around, and my signature is on the door.
We'll put a link to this scene in the show notes at thecyphershow.com.
And my mom was able to figure out that was my signature, and she had her share of concerns, of course. And I show up to school on Monday, and it was just like I hit the lotto. I was the most popular kid in most of my classes amongst all of the guys that wrote graffiti or knew I wrote graffiti. But that was the first indication that I was right. She had her suspicions, but right, her suspicions were confirmed by way of Kojak.
So it was a mix of things. She was upset, but also happy that you were on television?
You know, it made sense of these late hours and these parties that didn't get me home until 5 or 6 a.m.
Right.
In these middle of the week parties in friends' houses that I was never at.
Right.
So, and then a couple of months later, she was on the subway with a bunch of her friends, and she saw my name on the door. And she told me that she stood in front of the door to block it, hoping that none of her friends would say, "Gladys, isn't that your son's name on the door?" So, and then, you know, we've had an interesting relationship with it. She saw my name crossed out once, and maybe this was during the era of Colors being on HBO or something. And she called me with a tremendous concern, like, "Does this mean they're going to kill you now?" And I was like, "No, it's not that serious, Mom." But it really was a source of trouble in our home and conflict growing up. But it's very different now. You know, she understands that graffiti, in a weird way, made me very popular. I had a ton of friends. I had a ton of friends from all walks of life, which is very unique about the power of graffiti. You know, even sports to some degree was segregated, unless maybe you went to school at a private school and your team played other teams in different neighborhoods or something like that. But, you know, New York was still very segregated to some degree while I was growing up. And graffiti just had a very unique power of bringing kids together like no other New York pastime.
Yeah. Who were some of the first tags you remember seeing? Do you remember who they were?
Oh, yeah. It's about 5 years old, and I only remember this because we got out early for the day. It wasn't like first, second, or third grade where you get out at 3 o'clock. I think we were out by 12:30, 1 p.m. And my mom always had a little bit of time to kill between the time she picked up my older brother from school. And we were in Fort Greene. We were by Queen of All Saints. It's a Catholic school on Vanderbilt and Lafayette Avenue. In fact, it's where Biggie went to school. So Big grew up a couple of blocks from me. But my mom for some reason had to stop over there, and the school was letting out. And as all of the kids rushed to get in the front of the bus, two guys ran up on the back of the bus and started taking tags on the back of the bus. And it was a lesson learned early in life that the most obvious is often the least obvious. And I was the only witness to this relatively harmless misdemeanor crime.
Right.
But I was absolutely fascinated. So for the rest of my days, until I learned a little bit more about graffiti, I was under the impression that graffiti was done on the fly in public. So when I started to ride subways, I found myself scratching my head, like, how are they writing all of this graffiti in the interior of the subway car around all of these people during rush hour? And how are they painting the outsides of these trains? But the two guys that took tags were CPR and Nash. And I was told that CPR stood for Crazy Puerto Rican and that Nash was his partner. And they were from somewhere near Fort Greene, Bed-Stuy. I never met those guys, but they were early influences to me. And then we had friends. My mom had friends that lived in Flushing, Queens. So we would make the commute from the G train to the 7 line out to Flushing maybe 3 times a year. And when we pulled into Willits Point or 111th, one of the stations near Shea, or City Field now, there was a spy versus spy scenario going on. And I knew Mad Magazine. I was a small kid who didn't read it. And I was intrigued by that. And that was a part of graffiti that really resonated with me, was that the trains would often move by too fast. And my untrained eye was unable to decipher some of these complicated letter forms. Mm-hmm. But there was typically a character that I was familiar with from popular culture, comic books, or Saturday morning cartoons on the side of the subway train. And that really spoke to me. And, you know, there's Popeye and there's Shu from the Sunday comics. And I still remember seeing the scene car with the characters from Fantasia. And that was the part of graffiti that I really spoke to me as a small child.
And which you ended up, when you grew up, writing a whole book about the, characters.
Yes, yeah. Yes. We wrote a book, me and Todd James, my good friend Todd, wrote a book called Mascots and Mugs, the Characters and Cartoons of Subway Graffiti. Mm-hmm.
And what did you discover about why those characters were so prominent in sort of that wave of graffiti?
I think overall, for the same reasons they spoke to me, you know, these guys all grew up in the city during the same eras, and these cartoons were things that they watched or enjoyed drawing in their off time. And it was very interesting. Everybody kind of had their own slant on it, you know. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking to maybe someone that was African-American, he drew black characters, and then, you know, maybe the Italian guys or the Irish guys drew the same Muggsies, but they were white and they had straight hair. So everyone kind of put their regional or ethnic slant on it. And then, you know, there was this era of graffiti where it was kind of dark and people were drawing Grim Reapers and satanic stuff. And that wasn't a part of my experience growing up. You know, we grew up on disco. So I found it fascinating to hear from some of the guys that were inspired by Black Sabbath and some of the rock from that era. Mm-hmm. And it really was a fascinating experience. Talking to Mark Bodie was fascinating. For one, none of us knew how to pronounce his last name correctly. Everyone was like Bode or Bode, but it's Bodie. A lot of that's, his father's art was lowbrow. It wasn't something that you would expect.
So this is Von Bodie.
Von Bodie was an influential underground cartoonist best known for his character Cheech Wizard. Many early graffiti artists like Dondi, Scene, Tracy, and Mayor 139 included Bodie's characters in their work.
Yeah, his father's art was lowbrow art, and it really wasn't something that at the surface you would think would appeal to urban kids, inner city youths. And for the most part, I think that that's the market that really helped push the brand forward and make it iconic. Mm-hmm. You know, graffiti writers embraced his work. And I found that absolutely fascinating because I think that the art was originally designed for like deadhead type stoner guys.
Right.
Red R. Crumb and Zip Comics or Zap Comics. And it really was interesting how it wasn't his intended market. Mm-hmm. But that's really where his work seemed to flourish. And then, you know, Dondi, of course, embraced the character. And I think that really helped the brand to some degree.
Yeah. And so your tag, you know, Chino and Chino BYI, I guess. So who was the BYI crew? Did they exist before you became a part of them?
Yes. So Chino was a family nickname. I'm Puerto Rican and Filipino. I grew up with the Puerto Rican side of my family. All of my cousins and brothers have nicknames. And on the scale of names that my cousins were given, mine wasn't too bad. But my Uncle Vidal, rest in peace, was the first one to call me Chino as a small child. And I hated the nickname. I experimented with a bunch of tags in the sixth and seventh grade. And then eventually I just started writing my family nickname.
I know it was Dave was one, D was one.
D was the very first tag. Yeah. And it was sort of like rap was sort of big or get it. Well, big
everyone the, was a D or a ski.
Without a doubt. And that's what it was. So it was borrowed from that. And I drew a cloud around my D tag with a little lightning bolt coming out the bottom of it. And then eventually I started writing Chino. BYI was actually a breakdance crew, and it was Beyond Your Imagination. And my good friend Shretch, he was my mentor early on. He was like, hey, I'm taking over this breakdance crew, and we're turning it into a graffiti crew. And it was called Beyond Your Imagination. And he's like, I want you to be the vice president. And I was just like, I don't know if I want this responsibility. I really didn't know what it might entail at the time. Yeah, and that's my primary crew. So it sounds odd, you know, I'm obviously down with a bunch of crews, but my signature feels naked without the BYI beneath it. It's almost a part of my tag at this point. Mm. So Tretch is still officially the president of the crew. He retired in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. So I like to say that I'm just house-sitting for him.
Until he comes back.
While he's on hiatus, yeah.
So who else was in there? And it ended up being more than just writers, right?
Yeah, we had a bunch of guys. You know, there were a bunch of neighborhood guys that rolled with us that didn't write graffiti. And I would have much rather had put down someone that I had an affinity towards or was a good friend of mine or I knew had my back than have some, like, prolific artist who I hardly knew endorsing the crew. So we kind of have a tightly knit group of friends. The vast majority of the guys that I wrote graffiti with are guys that I'm still in touch with till this day. And we have this annual tradition where we get together the night before Thanksgiving. And it's been going on since the late 80s, and we still do it.
Wow.
Every year.
Amazing. So another crew that I've read you're affiliated with, you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, is MPC?
Yes.
The MPC, or Morris Park Crew, began in the 1970s in the Morris Park section of the Bronx. It was started by Slip 3 and Colt. Cap 1, a second-generation member of the crew, became infamous after his appearance in the 1983 documentary Style Wars.
So how did a Puerto Rican Filipino from Brooklyn fall in with the, you know, Irish crew from the Bronx?
I had some beef with some guys, and I don't know if I want to talk about that part on the air, because it's always odd, you know, it's 2016, and it's not something that's ever in the front of my thinking. But it's the stuff that people always want to talk about, the fights and the beef stuff. But I had beef with a very well-known crew. I ended up fighting with the president of that crew and beating him up. And it got a lot of attention and a lot of news circa 86. And some guys from Queens that had beef with the same crew as I did, the RIS guys, Ghost, Gatto, Neo, these guys reached out to me. It was actually Gatto that reached out to me. And the only graffiti of his that I was familiar with was that he was going over people on the one line and on the Bs and the BMTs and INDs. And I was like, oh, this guy is just so disrespectful. And I didn't realize that he was sort of like this younger foot soldier from an older crew that was sort of exacting revenge for Ghost and some of the senior members, you know? And he reached out to me over the phone. It's like, hey, listen, we've got issues with some of the same guys. It's like, I don't know about this meeting people over the phone shit. And I was a little skeptical. And I had some friends from Corona that I wrote graffiti with that lived in Corona and Jackson Heights and Elmhurst. And they all co-signed for him. They're like, he's a good dude. He's got respect for you. And he just wants to paint with you. And figured since you guys have mutual enemies in common, this could be a good fit. Mm-hmm. So I actually went out of my way one day to meet them in Flushing. We did a lot of painting. They were actually good guys. And they had a connection with the MPC guys. Mm-hmm. I met Cap. And then, oddly enough, he started attending New York City Technical College in Brooklyn. And it's downtown Brooklyn on J Street, which is 2-3 stops from where I live in Brooklyn, or where I grew up, rather. And we just connected. I sat in on a couple of art classes with Cap. And I was a very different human being during the 80s. Admittedly, my formative years might have lasted a little bit longer than most. I was still trying to figure things out. And I wasn't making very good decisions. Mm-hmm. And just to maybe help paint the picture, is that most of the guys that I grew up looking up to, you know, I started writing on trains in 1982. So I think we could use Style Wars as a good reference point. Is that a vast majority of those guys that are in the film were all involved in some sort of hostile cross-out war with another artist at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, that is a big theme in that movie.
He went over this?
Yup, he did a cap throw up over me and an NPC over this and wrote War next to Fat Albert.
Oh, shit.
You get him, man.
You can't never make up for that.
You gotta get that nigga on the
That's never
permanent.
Forgive action.
If you a toy, it gotta be stopped. And this guy's a toy and he's big and he still gotta be stopped.
He gotta be stopped.
And from Style Wars, you know, graffiti is a vocation. Its traditions and practices are handed down from one young generation to the next. So by the time the torch was passed to my generation, it was just beef central, you know, like everyone was beefing with somebody. And it was a very aggressive culture by the time I got involved. And, 9 out of 10 graffiti encounters when you met someone started out very aggressively. You know, guys that just look at you, kind of, you could see it coming. Just like, yo, you right? What you right? You're going to ask what you write. And then it's like, why, are you afraid to tell me? And you're getting challenged from the onset, from the beginning of this encounter. And guys were walking up to me and putting their shoe next to my shoe to see if my sneaker might fit their foot because they could be curious or interested in taking it. They'd walk by you and just pat down your pockets. So the culture was very aggressive
mm-hmm.
by the time we started writing graffiti. And I might have even lost track of the question I was.
Oh, it started just asking about MPC.
Yeah. And so it was a good fit, you know. I was up for a fight back in the 80s. And Cap seemed to have his share of problems. And we just kind of connected. And then go figure, a couple of months later, I end up beating up some guys that Cap had beef with in the city. They actually pressed charges on me. They were dropped. It was on Halloween evening. We were taking tags in the village, and dude was like, yo, let me get that can. And I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me, right? That bad attitude. And he was with a big group of guys, and he starts telling me where he's from and what he writes. And when he mentions the Bronx, I mention MPC. And he's like, we walk into a deli, we come out with some beers, and then they're whispering about going over the tag as we walk past on the way, and then a fight breaks out. But I guess because I think the dynamics of the community Cap lived in, he might not have been able to smack this kid on his own. So he was sort of thrilled that someone was able to do it for him. But I think that sort of solidified our bond. Mm-hmm. And I refer to him as Robbie. He's a good guy. Some of the very first interviews he did post-Style Wars, he did with me. And I think it was the first 3 interviews. And Style Wars left him jaded. He wasn't very happy with the way he was portrayed in the film. I mean, those beliefs are something that I believe he embodied while the film was being filmed.
Anybody tries to screw around with me and my friends, I go over everything they got forever. Everybody from Brooklyn to Manhattan. Everybody.
Then as he matured, I think that he lived to regret being vilified by this film that had received international attention. You know,
sure.
And until this day, someone could post Style Wars, a clip of it to their Facebook account. You've got kids in Norway getting bent out of shape, wanting to go to the bench and get united and avenge this guy. Like, and it's still to this day, I think, has the power of really riling people up. But he's a very different human being. And I think it's safe to say that none of us could be judged for the rest of our lives for the decisions we've made in our teenage years.
Right. Exactly. You wouldn't want what you did in 1982 to define you for the rest of your life. So there were so many writers that you knew, and you mentioned one who I wanted to get into a little bit, who was Dondi.
Yes.
Donald Joseph White, a.k.a. Dondi, was one of the most influential graffiti writers ever. He pioneered many of the styles and techniques still used by modern graffiti artists. He was the first graffiti artist to have a one-man show in the Netherlands and Germany, and his work is collected by European museums. He died in 1998 of complications from AIDS.
Why was he so important?
Stylistically, I think the contribution that Dondi made to the movement, I mean, I can see his influence on his contemporaries and the future generations of graffiti. And some of my favorite artists were inspired by Dondi and are practitioners of his style or subscribe to or have studied his style. And Dondi's work was very clean and it was tight. And, you know, if we point to that top to bottom Dondi whole car that's in Subway Art, I mean, symmetrically, it's one of the best whole cars. It just fits on the entire car perfectly.
That's interesting. I hadn't realized that being clean was such a value placed on that amongst writers. Can you talk about that?
I think it's like anything else. Like if you call a repairman into your home to fix the hole in the wall, it's nice and smooth and painted and you don't know there was a hole there. He did an excellent job. He's professional. But if there's some bumps and it's not sanded properly and the paint job's kind of crappy, you're going to not appreciate the job as much. And I think the same could be said for graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons why his work stood out. You know, it's sort of like Scene. You know, I would look at these Scene cars as well. And they were so clean and they encompassed everything that I felt like graffiti needed to have. There was this character from popular culture in 3D and the piece was designed and filled in and decorated rather. And it was a solid fill in and paint was not obviously not an issue. And then you'd look at some of the other stuff next to it. And you're just like, oh, that's nowhere near as polished as this piece. And Dondi's work was the same. I feel like it sort of was had the same standard, you know. Dondi's letter forms were far more, no diss to Scene, sophisticated or maybe intricate rather than his. But I think the level of professionalism that went into his work was really the hallmark of Dondi's, you know, work on trains.
Yeah. Who were the first people you remember painting trains, like whole cars?
This is interesting. And I'll just give you a quick story as we get there. But we used to go to Red Hook Pool in Brooklyn. We went to McCarrion Pool, Red Hook Pool as kids. And there was a graffiti as an art piece on the wall in Red Hook Projects. It was painted by REC, R-E-K, NSA, Nonstop Action, or UWB, United We Bomb. And REC was an artist from Red Hook. And the piece said graffiti as an art. And I spoke to me. I was a small kid. I was probably in the sixth grade at the time. I was like, this is dope. I'm going to figure out how to get back here and I'm going to take a picture of it. And I stole my mom's 110 camera. I went, I snapped some photos of the wall. And then a couple of weeks later, I see that piece in the Daily News and it's promoting a show. I think it was a graffiti above ground gallery show, which is in Style Wars.
The past 20 years, there really hasn't been anything hot. There have been no movements since pop art. Any retailer, and let's face it, a gallery is indeed a retailer. They're always looking for something hot that they can merchandise and sell to the public.
It's almost as though these pieces were peeled off the train and put onto canvas. So you have the same energy, you have the same coloring, you have the same intensity and the same big piece that you would see on a train.
The real subway.
So I cut school. I'd never been to Manhattan by myself before. And I cut school with this kid named Justin. And we attended the show during the day. And the poster that Mayor Koch is reading in Style Wars was for sale there. It might have been $20. In the sixth grade, they might as well said it was $5,000.
Right,
it's just not something I could afford at the time. And I remember all of these amazing pieces in that poster, including the Dondi piece. So the irony is, as I get off the subway, I'm open. Like, this is my first opportunity to scrutinize graffiti at length without feeling intimidated. I'm not on a train platform. It's not zipping past me really quickly. I'm not in a dangerous neighborhood. I'm in a gallery in Soho, and I can just stare at the stuff and soak it all up. And I kind of left. I felt like I was like a wino at a wine tasting, you know, like I couldn't get enough. And as I'm leaving the show, the Dondi car pulls into the platform opposite of me. And I'm just in awe of this thing. And that was the first top to bottom whole car I think I had witnessed.
Wow. That reminds me of something else I wanted to ask you is you saw probably three or four waves of intersection between the art world, the so-called proper art world of galleries and graffiti, right? There was, you know, one in the, you know, in the 70s, there was the sort of early 80s wave you're talking about that, you know, you can see in Style Wars, probably again in around maybe 1990, once stuff fell off in the train, you know, that happened again. What was that like for you to sort of see these waves happening? And were there any kind of differences between them when they came through?
Good question. I think that maybe some of the early 80s stuff was just trying to figure out if there's a place for it in the art world. And I think some of that was hit or miss. There were a handful of guys that have really been able to sustain themselves and are still doing shows till this day. You know, guys like Daze and Crash and Sharp and Quick and a ton of other guys. But there are a ton of guys that probably gave it a good stab and just didn't quite make it. Or it's not easy being an artist. I'm sure anyone will tell you that. And I think a lot of those guys just, life events and milestones, new priorities, just couldn't afford to continue to focus on their art careers. And then I like what I see what's going on today. You know, there are a handful of guys that have really made it and are accepted as fine artists and are traveling the world, you know, living off of their fine art right now. And it feels a little bit more genuine. In the arts hanging in bigger places, more reputable galleries, homes, and cultural institutions around the world.
Right. I mean, you know, again, to go back to Style Wars, that's one of the funniest parts of Style Wars is the gallery show and sort of the different people at the gallery show and how they're, you know, reacting to this art and talking about it. And it's kind of like they don't get it, but they feel like they have to have it there in some ways.
As an investment, I feel so strongly that if you get in on the bottom of anything, it's got to be a good investment, and this is definitely going someplace. But
and, you know, it's not just graffiti. There have been a ton of art waves and things that people gravitate to, which is the must-have item of that season or era or year, and then you look back on it 10 years from now, and you're like, what the hell was I thinking with that haircut or buying that painting? Or,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we had Say Adams on the show a while ago and talked to him about that whole idea of like interacting with buyers in that era.
It was very strange to have all those, you know, people in suits and, you know, really established people buying the work and being fascinated by it. And being a young kid, it was really weird to kind of be in that environment because you have to conduct yourself as a professional adult. And it's kind of weird to be able to do that and then kind of go back and hang out with your friends shortly thereafter.
And, you know, we flash forward to 2016 and it's, you know, I mean, artists have a huge hand in pushing their own artwork forward, but it's not their responsibility to do it typically. And, you know, you've got gallerists and publicists and all of these other people helping push this thing forward for you, which is awesome. And it's, you know, evolved into a real business.
Right.
Whereas I think you were required to put on a monkey suit or a tie and look your Sunday best and sort of tap dance and be at your best behavior while trying to impress somebody. And I think that, you know, a lot of these guys were from the streets and it's not always easy. You know, I mean, I understand that from firsthand experience. It's not always easy transitioning from having a foot in the street and then working in a corporate setting or dealing with people that are just of a greater intellect and education than you and trying to figure out how to have that conversation, you know,
right.
in your real worlds, you're probably never going to cross paths with these guys growing up. And now you're forced to sort of learn how to interact and communicate with these folks.
Right. And one of the most fascinating things about that and about, you know, the area you started as a whole is that everyone was a kid. Can you talk about that and sort of maybe the influence that had on the shape that the art took and the culture took and, You know, I mean, everyone was so young when started out.
That's one thing that people don't really consider, is that this was a movement that was, you know, pioneered by children. None of us were old enough to drink or drive or vote or do anything, make any important decisions on our own. But when you stop to think about it, this was a multi-million dollar issue for the state and the transit authority for several years, from the early 70s until 1988. It's almost 20 years, maybe 20 plus years. I mean, there's still illegal graffiti going on in subways, not at the same pace it was in the 80s, but almost 20 years, and these are children that are running this branch of the government, and it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, we have access to all of these dangerous spaces. We figured out schedules on our own. And I'll maintain this. Graffiti artists are the most resourceful people on the planet. We figure out how to make our own keys, and we figure out where the important things are. And, you know, for instance, I could get a skeleton key and bend it slightly, and I have a BMTIND key, and I can open up the train. And if the key doesn't work, I can kick in the conductor's booth door just at the bottom where the door flexes. And in the dark, I can find the lump on the wall, and the first switch beyond the lump will turn on the fans, and the one beyond that will turn on the lights. So now I have lights in the tunnel, and wherever you see a blue light in the train tunnel, there's an emergency exit nearby, there's a phone nearby, and there's a fire extinguisher nearby. So I can go to that phone, and I can ask for an outside line. And with the outside line, I can call one of my friends and say, hey, listen, I'm in the 155th Street tunnel. We're painting trains. I'm low on ink. I'm thirsty. And bring a sandwich. And my friends that lived in the Polo Grounds would come down with food and water and extra ink. And now I don't have to leave the layup. And my friends know I'm in Harlem without me having to get on the platform and get change and use a payphone. And if the police should come, I could use the fire extinguisher. And in a cloud of smoke, I'm out of the emergency hatch. So as we flash forward to 2016, you know, terrorism has really changed the way people view people entering tunnels.
Right. You've been pretty vocal about that, about like, hey, you know, now it looks very different to go into a dark tunnel with a bag and
a hood over my head and a group of my friends.
Right.
It looks very suspicious. But it was our norm during the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this was 20 years before anyone coined the term urban exploration. You know, I've been in all sorts of interesting tunnels and places that I had no business in and that were very dangerous. And unlike most of the people that work down there, I didn't need to take a state-regulated or mandated federally safety test or training course by OSHA to figure out my way around the tunnel. I learned my way around a tunnel at 14 years old from a guy that learned it from a 14-year-old the year before he taught me how to do it. You know, and these trade secrets were sort of passed down from one young generation to the next.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned the cops a second ago, and the relationship between writers and the Vandal Squad before buffing kind of changed everything is super interesting to me. I get the impression that you kind of viewed each other as worthy adversaries in a way.
It was a cat and mouse game. And when, you know, I have had the misfortune of being arrested by Vandal Squad on a couple of occasions. I never gave up my name. I never gave up any of the other artists that they were interested in. But I was always fascinated with just how much graffiti, how much information they were familiar with. And they had a relatively reasonable idea of where some of these guys were from, what some of them looked like. And, you know, they would tell me things like, oh, this guy, he'll never get caught again. He's way too smart for this. And they clearly had a respect. And they showed me a list of names. 1986, I believe it was, summertime, we were coming out of the Coney Island Yard, which is the Dewey Yard near John Dewey High School. It's the largest train yard in all of New York City. 1985, 1986, it was like summer camp for me. I spent my entire summer in and out of that yard. And I got caught coming out of it. We were actually lingering in the neighborhood at the time because my good friend Tony Trim, his girlfriend lived in Marlboro Projects. I wasn't very well liked in that area, and I was going over somebody who I had issues with, and it was my mistake. We should have just left the yard and went straight home.
Yeah.
But I got arrested outside the yard. And I had train keys on me, a workman vest, spray paint, a knife in my bag, and some other things.
A workman vest?
Yeah, yeah. Just trying to blend in, and like, you know, if they spot us in the yard, hopefully they think we're track workers working in the yard.
Hmm.
And the criminal impersonation charge wasn't as serious back in 86 as it is in 2016. Hmm. I mean, I could probably end up on the news for doing something like that today, whereas it just wasn't a big deal.
Right.
You know, it wasn't even something that ended up on the docket when we were arrested at the time.
Oh.
But we got taken into the station. And they showed me a list of graffiti names, and there was a line through the list. And they're like, do you guys know anyone above this line? This is who we're looking for. And my name was on that list above the line. And I was honored and shaking in my boots at the same time. And I'm like, geez, if they find out, I'm going to get in trouble and what have you. But thankfully, you know, it wasn't a very serious crime back then. You typically ended up doing couple of days of community service.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny.
And then meeting other writers from all around the city.
It was a criminal think tank. You know, it's the worst thing they could have possibly done, because now you're with guys that tell you where they got caught and when not to go there, right? So
yeah.
You leave with more information than you arrived with that day. And,
right.
And to be quite honest, I got over it, community service, constantly, because they would ask, all right, who wants to do this? And I couldn't believe that people were raising their hands like, I want a mop. Give me that mop. And I just realized, you know, if you keep your hand down, eventually there'll be no mops left, or there'll be no brooms left. But we were scrubbing trains at the time. So the train would pull into Church Avenue. You'd spend your Saturday mornings there. They'd give you a vest, a helmet, and long rubber gloves,
mm-hmm.
solution, and Brillo. And you would just saturate the inside of the car, sort of like a Karate Kid style. You're sitting there, you know, trying to remove graffiti on a Saturday afternoon. And then you rinse the car down. Someone comes through and mops. But if you don't volunteer for something,
mm-hmm.
eventually there's just nothing for you to do. And they're like, all right, well, you just help out however they need you. Or you do this. Or, all right, just sit here for now. And I'm just like, all right, cool, I'll do that.
Right.
And they would typically cut you at lunch. They would let you leave for an hour. You had to sign back in. If you didn't show back up, you'd end up going back to court. And then typically, after they realized that everyone was back, they would cut you for the day. So it was usually a half day of community service, which I felt was more than fair in exchange for the volumes of trains that I had written on prior to getting caught.
Right. And interestingly, though, you know, in recent years, you have tried to dissuade people who got caught from doing it again.
In recent years, Chino and other veteran writers have been involved in a program with Brooklyn Family Court called Pain Straight. It trains kids who have been caught writing graffiti to use their artistic talents for legal pursuits.
So I wouldn't say I'm trying to dissuade anyone as much as we're trying to find positive outlets for all of this creative energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it exists. I mean, man has had the desire to engrave his name on walls and public spaces since the dawn of time, from the caves to the ancient city of Pompeii. And, you know, you can go to any bathroom in New York City, and some guy that's never written anything illegal is probably going to write on the bathroom wall at some point. It's just, it's in our nature. So, you know, when I was growing up, there wasn't necessarily a next level for this craft. And when I was growing up, there wasn't a felony charge attached to getting arrested for graffiti. So I really try and emphasize to kids just how serious it is incurring a felony at a very young age.
Mm.
You know, like, some of these kids are still in junior high school or high school. You're not eligible for college grants with a felony on your record. You know, you're not eligible for employment. You lose most of your constitutional rights. You can't vote. There are a ton of countries that won't allow you to visit if you've got a felony on your record. And the list goes on. So because the game has changed, since the rules have changed, I just try and promote a different aspect of it.
Yeah.
You know, kids are going to write on whatever they want to write on. But if you can inspire a handful of guys to maybe take their craft seriously and realize that there's opportunities. You know, again, there wasn't any post-graffiti plan for most of the guys from my generation. A lot of guys just quit and moved on with their lives. And there are legitimate opportunities out there today. And it really runs the gamut. You know, you've got guys designing fashion and apparel and video games and art direction and commercial muralists and running their own businesses and graphic companies. They're living off of fine art. And it's everything under the sun these days.
So one of the first opportunities you created for yourself, you know, once the sort of writing days were winding down, was going to The Source and, you know, writing a column about graffiti there.
Chino worked at The Source for 11 years, editing the Bomb Shelter and Graflix features.
In a way, you were kind of curating how graffiti appeared to other folks interested in hip hop culture at that point by taking in, you know, audience photographs and kind of choosing which ones would run. Did you feel like you were in a position of influence while you were there?
I had no idea at the time. You know, it sort of started out by accident. Was that The Source ran some graffiti in an issue. And there were a handful of artists that they profiled who I was big fans of. And they got the text wrong. They got the information wrong. And I knew a bunch of guys working there at the time. You know, my good friend Rob Tulo, Reef, was working there. And that's how I became familiar with The Source. So I reached out to some of the guys that were at the magazine. I was like, listen, if you ever have any questions about this stuff, feel free to give me a call. And if it's something I can help you with, I'd be more than happy to get you the proper, you know, information. And they were like, why don't you just do next month's issue? And it sort of started out on a trial basis. You know, they weren't even... Graflix wasn't a consistent feature in the magazine just yet, and we were splitting a page with a column called Unsigned Hype, where aspiring rappers would mail in their demo tapes to be profiled. Guys like Eminem, Common, or as he was then known as Common Sense, and a ton of other big rappers got their start through Unsigned Hype. But I was competing for space with another column. And then in no time, they would do these surveys annually, and an umbrella group came in and did a survey and found out that Graflix was the most popular section of the magazine with their 13 to 35 demographic. And the only area of the magazine that was circulating sales outside of their target demographic. So there were guys that were, you know, grunge kids and new wave kids and listened to freestyle music and hardcore and had interests outside of hip-hop that were still buying the magazine just for that page
every month. Yeah.
And then we had this community of guys that were over 35, which was the senior graffiti guys, the pioneers, that it was the only publication available at their local Blockbuster where you could find a Tracy 168 piece or a Phase 2 piece or a Comet piece or something from the early mid 70s. So it was circulating sales outside of their target market. And once they understood the popularity of the page, I got a full page. So it was typically in the back of the magazine, which is what I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
But till this day, I meet people that tell me, as soon as the issue came out, I turned to the back of the page. I didn't even read the rest of the magazine. And I'd meet people that were like, dude, I would steal it from the Hudson News, just one page, and then leave. I met Cormega at a show at Rikers Island. Big Pun, Fat Joe were performing, and Cormega had served his time in Rikers Island. Nas says, what's up with Cormega? Did you see him and y'all together? In One Love, Cormega was locked up at the time, and Cormega told me that his cell was plastered with Graflix columns, that he would tear the page up monthly while he was locked up. And the feedback I got from international graffiti artists, still fascinating. You know, some of my favorite international artists have told me that my skill set had increased exponentially. After Graflix came out, I had something from New York to reference that wasn't in Subway Art or Style Wars.
Wow.
And it was all of this unique content. And a part of my goal was that, you know, Subway Art and Style Wars are fascinating documentations of the culture, but you've got a limited amount of space in the... Part of the mission was trying to shine a light on some of my favorite artists and some of the guys that missed the spotlight. So the column was never about me. I've never once used any of my art in the issue. Art director slipped in a mural I did in the 100th anniversary issue because he loved the wall and was like, you focus on everyone else's work but your own. You should be in the magazine eventually. And they slipped in one of my murals. But in 11 years, I never once thought to use any of my own content. It was a vehicle to promote a culture that I was fond of and trying to give some of these unsung heroes some shine.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was hosting Star Search after a certain point. It was really difficult to get content in the beginning.
Yeah.
And people will either support you because they believe in what you're doing, or they've seen some of their contemporaries in print and don't want to be left out.
Right.
Right? So it's either the support and love they have for you that they want to contribute.
Or they're like, well, so-and-so got in there.
Or if you're going to use this guy, you have to take this.
Me, yeah.
So then, you know, the floodgates sort of started to open, and then it was... It wasn't a matter, in the beginning, it was a matter of where am I going to get content from monthly, and then it was a matter of when am I going to get around to actually using this stuff, because I have way more photos than I have space right now.
Right. One other thing about the source from that era is you guys got to hear so much music that, for one reason or another, never ended up being released, whether due to, you know, mostly, I'm assuming, sample clearance issues or whatever. What is some of the stuff you remember best, or maybe, you know, snuck surreptitious copies of that the world at large never got to hear?
Oh, wow. I could go on. This is so it's not the same as today. You know, hip hop is such a big business, and it wasn't, not saying that it wasn't, but if you were going to do an interview with Redman, Redman showed up at the office. You didn't deal with his publicist. You didn't send questions to someone that screened them, and then, you know, you assigned the photographer, he dealt with them. The images weren't sent to you from the label. The interviews weren't screened. Someone showed up, Wu-Tang showed up at the office, all 30 something of them, right?
Yeah.
So, wow. We would get albums sometimes 9 months before they were commercially released. I mean, I had Illmatic a year before this thing came out. We had KRS's Return of the Boom Bap a year before this thing was commercially available. I still have Biggie's demo that he gave me a year before it was commercially released. So there are a handful of samples on his demo that weren't cleared.
Mm-hmm.
So the version I have is very different. There are some different tracks on there.
Why not blow up the spot with Sadat? Release the brainstorm to make your motherfucking brain warm. A strange form, something kind of lyrical. Biggie the bastard, Sadat's kind of spiritual. I'm sticking ice picks on the tip of your dick. Give your testicles a swift kick. Ain't that some shit? Am I hardcore? Harder than the Plymouth? It ain't no myth. It's a nigga with a split and a front for fifth.
The intro is different.
Push, come on. Watch how head goes. I see the head. Come on. Yeah! Yeah!
Mary J. Blige and Method Man rhyming over "You're All That I Need." The version I have, they're going over the original Marvin Gaye track. The commercially released version, they redid the Marvin Gaye track.
I'm your mister, you my missus, with hugs and kisses, Valentine cards and birthday wishes. Please be on another level of planning, of understanding, the bond between man and woman and chap.
I like the version I have a lot better than the commercially released version. No disrespect, but I felt like they ruined it on the album after hearing the first version.
Mm-hmm.
I have a bunch of tracks from the Brand Nubians when they thought they were going to release a second album as a collective. They ended up breaking up. Poobah started a solo career, and Lord Jamar and Sadat moved on to do records on their own. But I have about 4 or 5 tracks where the three of them are rhyming that was supposed to be on a second album.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's a ton of interesting stuff, some Keith Murray tracks, mm-hmm. And some other random tracks that just never came out. I have something that I don't know if it's appropriate to share on the air, but it's some of my favorite rappers being very homophobic, and I won't call them out because it's unfair, but and it was a different era.
Mm-hmm.
But that type of stuff just wouldn't fly in 2016. And if this thing leaked out, I'm sure they'd be harshly criticized mm-hmm. for it. And hopefully some of their views on what they were rapping about have changed since.
Right.
But yeah, there's a ton of really offensive music that probably never made the cut that I probably have sitting in a shoebox somewhere in storage.
Yeah. You know, you are from Brooklyn, from Fort Greene, as you mentioned. Fort Greene has changed very dramatically in the past 5, 10, 15 years. I don't want to lead you about it in any way. Just kind of what are some of your thoughts about how, you know, your neighborhood has changed?
It's scary. I don't always recognize the community I grew up in. Don't always feel a part of it anymore. I have a good friend that retired and left New York 3 years ago. And I said, "You're leaving Brooklyn." He said, "Correction, Brooklyn left me a long time ago." And it really spoke to me. I try not to be one of those guys that's hung up on when I was growing up, this was better and that was better. It's always a good time if you, just a matter of perspective, you know? And, but I don't always recognize Brooklyn. I see the beauty and I see the appeal. It's a relatively easy commute to, Manhattan, tree-lined streets, brownstone blocks, gorgeous. And, you know, I grew up in Fort Greene, ton of beautiful homes in Fort Greene, but they were allowed to hit rock bottom during the 70s and 80s. The underlying beauty was always there. They just weren't cared for. And then crack really took a toll on life here in New York. Some of the most dangerous blocks in Brooklyn now have, you know, like glass facade, condominium, doorman buildings there. And it's strange, but I do have some issues. Pricing anyone out of a community just doesn't, it's just not right. And I don't think there's a greater crime than displacing someone in their senior years. You know, it's hard enough to move, especially when you're young. But having lived somewhere for 40 or 50 years and being forced out, you know, during your golden years is just a crime. And then typically, where are you forced into? A lower income community that might not be as safe. You know, my mom's got a 3-bedroom apartment that we grew up in. She no longer has 3 kids living in the house, but they would love that back. And they've tried their hardest to push her out. And, you know, when I was growing up, people were getting shot on the block I grew up on. No, we didn't have any restaurants that delivered to our apartment. You know, if they did, you'd have to come downstairs. They didn't want to come into the building. And now she can get anyone to deliver to the building. And the neighborhood's the safest I've ever seen it. You know, we'd have to travel outside of our community to go shopping because there just weren't in the resources we needed available locally. Mm-hmm. So if we wanted to go to a supermarket, it was a bit of a commute. And now there's a 24-hour Pathmark near her and a Starbucks just up the block, and she can order sushi or Thai food or anything she wants to eat at any hour of the day. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame that the people that have seniority in communities aren't allowed to reap any benefits from being there this long, that those are the ones that are typically pushed out and often looked at as leftovers, like, oh, these guys are still here. And, you know, you go anywhere in the world, and I think it's important that you acclimate yourself to the community that or the region of the world that you're traveling to as a visitor. And if you plan on moving into a new neighborhood, it's just really hard that new people come in and set rules for the community you grew up in. You know, and I see the kids up the block who are good kids. They might be guilty of playing music a little loud outside their car and drinking beer on the stoop from time to time. But they get harassed endlessly. And then, you know, just a couple of blocks over, we've got folks sitting on a stoop playing the guitar, drinking wine, and they're not harassed the same way. And it's just, it's disappointing. You know, if you're going to police this community, and if this is an infraction worthy of harassing these kids about, you need to go over there and have dude put the guitar away and put the Merlot away, right? Like, this is not cool.
Yeah.
So there are a handful of things that really bother me, but I think that the finance part of it all, you know, is that vast majority of these people are pushed out of the community because they can't afford to live there, and they're being discriminated against for just based on income at the end of the day. And I don't, any discrimination just isn't acceptable,
right?
But we just need a better plan. You know, it feels like colonialism. Like, if you're going to move into a community, then acclimate yourself to the community. Maybe add something, but rebranding something, you know, and I understand, like, you know, calling it Bushwick is just too scary. Let's call this East Williamsburg, and let's, you know, but you're in Bushwick. It was Bushwick the entire time I was a kid. And how's it East Williamsburg today? And it's just maybe not as intimidating, but there's a history there, and you need to respect history. It's important.
Yeah.
And so I have a ton of issues. I don't know if there are any communities in the United States that have seen as much gentrification as the neighborhood I live in. I'm a couple of blocks from a basketball stadium. You know, I live near the Barclays. Mm-hmm. I played in those tracks as a small child. I wrote my first graffiti beneath the Barclays Center in the train tracks from the Long Island Railroad. In fact, there's a business that used to exist on the corner of the Barclays. It was called Samuel Underberg's. And they were a supermarket wholesaler, and they sold supermarket supplies. So during the mid to late 80s, the interior of most of the BMT and IND subways were covered with purple ink. It was Garvey ink, and it was made for the price stamping guns, and you could get Garvey at Samuel Underberg. So we would stand outside Underberg and shake kids down on a Friday night for their ink, or Friday afternoon, rather, knowing that they wanted to paint trains over the weekend.
Right.
And it was a gold mine. I could sit there for 2 or 3 hours on a Friday afternoon and just catch kids leaving and take their ink.
Amazing. And, you know, one last thing, speaking of Brooklyn and changing Brooklyn. A while ago, I was in downtown Brooklyn, and I saw a giant building with a bunch of words on it. And I couldn't tell what it was. I said, is this an ad I don't understand? Is this an art project? What is it? And I come to find out that you had played an important part in that.
Yes. It's Macy's parking garage, which is now slated for demolition. And it's a part of a project called the Love Letter to Brooklyn that I worked with Steve Powers, Espo. And he did a project called the Love Letter to Philadelphia Love Letter. And he painted, I believe it was 50 buildings in the West Philadelphia community that he grew up in, facing the elevated train. And essentially, it was like an endearing love letter to the city that nurtured him. And Steve has got a fascinating way with words and illustrating them. And it was such a success that he was invited to Syracuse to do a love letter to Syracuse. And when there was a conversation about a love letter to Brooklyn, typically his method was that he would go to a community and he would survey as many people as he could about what they loved about the neighborhood and what they hated about it. And in this particular instance, he invited me, and I was the only person that he talked to. So the art that decorates the parking garage was inspired by lots of conversations between me and Steve. So, you know, sort of like it says, I was nurtured here. I have 10 stitches on my head from a fight. I was sutured here. They didn't like the sutured part, so it was like I was nurtured here. And across the top of the building, which starts on Hoyt, runs across Livingston, Elm, and then the final bit of detail is on Fulton. It says, take a trip downtown, meet me downtown for a few old roads, lead home. And all of the roads from downtown Fulton lead to my house. I can take any bus back from Fulton pretty much 25, 26, 38, 52, 45, 41. And essentially all roads from Fulton lead home. But it's fascinating because I worked at Macy's at some point during the 80s. I still have tags in the sub-basement and all the freight elevators. An electrician recently told me this on the subway. He's like, I work in Macy's. He's like, you've got tags everywhere. What did you do there? And I worked in statistics. And I was in an office and I'd have to take back elevators and get receipts from all of the tri-state area stores. But I was working there and I would just write on things. So it's fascinating that I've written inside the building, I've written outside the building illegally, and 20-something years later, I'm invited back to decorate the exterior of their parking garage with graffiti. But it had a tremendous run. It got a lot of good press, and it was a fun project to work on, and it gave me an opportunity to salute the place that I call home.
That sounds like a great note to end on. Chino BYI, David Villarante, thanks for coming through.
Thank you for having me. It's a good time. Thank you, Sean.
It's always great when we get a chance to talk to someone in the graffiti world here on The Cypher. Our past chats with Keo and Say Adams have been some of my favorite episodes. Chino was right up there as well. I learned so much by hearing him talk about the different artists he's known and admired, and about their influences like Von Bode. As an added bonus, it was very cool to hear what it was like to work at The Source during its heyday, and to finally figure out what was going on with that huge building in downtown Brooklyn. Remember that our summer schedule has us dropping episodes every other week, so join us in 2 weeks when we talk to the producer Illmind. Illmind has not only made some of your favorite beats of the last several years for artists like Drake, J. Cole, Joell Ortiz, and Scarface, He's also managed to use his skills to start multiple businesses aimed at helping aspiring producers. The beatmakers among you will definitely not want to miss this. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, where you can help us out for as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
Does this mean they're going to kill you now?
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
You know, I've been in all sorts of interesting tunnels and places.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I never gave up my name. I never gave up any of the other artists that they were interested in.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
9 out of 10 graffiti encounters when you met someone started out very aggressively.
Special thanks to our Patreon supporter, Brian.
That felt like I was like wino at a wine tasting.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Madonna stole one of her boyfriends who was a graffiti writer.